Thanks, Ravi. It's very good to be back. In case you want to talk more after this talk, I'm here for another 2 weeks, roughly. I'm in Office 370, so just, you know, drop by and say hi. I'd be happy to chat. Right, so today's talk consists in a small part of a brief general overview of what falls under quantum machine learning, sort of what you get when you merge those two disciplines. And the main part of the talk focuses on autonomous learning agents. So what do we mean by autonomous learning agents? What kind of features define them? Then I'm going to talk about one particular framework, a model of autonomous learning agents. And after that, I'll talk about several applications in different fields. So quantum experiments, then one application that tells us something about a philosophical question. The next one is mostly about biology, so collective behavior in animals. And finally, one more abstract and more, I guess, open questions part, which is whether these agents can develop structured models of the environment. Okay, so before I talk about... by the way, is there any way to tell whether the microphone is working, or will I find out afterwards?
Yes, your mic's working.
Oh, great, thank you. right, so before I talk about quantum machine learning, just a brief distinction between machine learning and AI in general. So artificial intelligence, just like natural intelligence, is kind of hard to define. There's one really nice quote along the lines of, "We call anything intelligent that computers can't do yet." I couldn't find out from whom this quote is, so I didn't put it in here. But for the sake of concreteness, here are some areas on which AI researchers are currently working. So one of them is knowledge representation, meaning how do you structure knowledge and how do you represent it in a database, essentially, in such a way that an artificial intelligence can use it to solve certain practical or not so practical tasks. And closely related is the question of automated reasoning. So what kinds of deductions and inferences can you make based on the knowledge base you have? For example, if you know that Aristotle was a man and, what was it, all men die, I think, what allows you to make the inference that Aristotle will die? A second big area is computer vision and perception along with robotics. So the problem of building, for example, self-driving cars, or maybe some of you have seen the video of the more recent robots from Boston Dynamics that can drive around, jump, go through extremely rough terrain, carry weights. It's quite impressive what they're doing. Another area that falls under AI is natural language processing. I mean, if you want your AI to pass, for example, a Turing test or even play Jeopardy, it needs to be able to interface with natural language, which is inconveniently complex and irregular. Now, for most of these areas, at least the initial ansatz was to actually hard code logical structures, the form of databases, rules for governing your limbs and responding to perturbations, ways language is structured. But this approach is, for one thing, very cumbersome and also not particularly effective, because all of these artificial intelligences are going to be confronted with a world that is extremely complex and unforeseeable. So this ansatz of pre-programming rules was gradually superseded by the idea of having machines learn them themselves. So you give your artificial intelligence a huge amount of data and tell it to make something of it. And this is basically what machine learning does. So the idea that you do not program your computer completely, but rather allow it to learn for itself what it needs to do. And this ansatz is being combined with quantum mechanics. Now, when you want to merge these two fields, there are basically two ways you can go. The first of which is to use quantum mechanics to solve machine learning problems more efficiently. This is similar to the idea of quantum computing, where you have computing problems and you want to somehow exploit quantum mechanics to solve them more efficiently. But here, we're dealing with a slightly different class of problems. I mean, obviously, you can take any machine learning algorithm and run it on a universal computer, by definition, pretty much. But we want to see what advantages we can get when we focus specifically on machine learning kinds of tasks. So, for example, pattern recognition. And the work that has been done in this field falls roughly into two categories, depending on what kind of hardware implementation you need. So the first, maybe more near-term ansatz, assumes that you have an annealer, which allows you to basically solve optimization problems very efficiently. Another interesting thing you can do with that is to have a content addressable memory, so a kind of memory that stores different, say, bit strings in such a way that you can retrieve them, not by saying where they are located in the memory by an address, but rather by inputting a pattern that's somewhat similar to one of the existing ones. So it's closer to something that our brains can do, where you see a cat that looks slightly different from all the cats you've seen before, but it still triggers the abstract notion of cat. And it turns out that by encoding the patterns that you have, the ones you want to recognize, in a Ising-Hamiltonian, essentially, you can store more patterns in the same amount of memory and still retrieve them with a limited error. The second big part of quantum enhanced machine learning actually assumes that you have a universal quantum computer. And with this, you can achieve an advantage in machine learning tasks mostly in one of two ways. Either by essentially Grover search. It turns out that there are different machine learning problems that you can reformulate in a way that they're amenable to this method. And secondly, you're going to basically exploit the fact that a 2 to the n classical bit string can be encoded in n qubits. Therefore, any operation that scales in a certain way with the number of qubits is going to scale exponentially more favorably in the number of classical bits in your string. And in particular, it turns out that linear algebra tasks are of a type that can be solved very conveniently here. So these are just two seminal results that triggered a sort of whole explosion of methods for addressing machine learning tasks. One of them was that you can solve linear systems more efficiently, and those underlie, for example, linear regression. And the other one is the fact that you can take exponentials of matrices, which also plays an important role, for example, in principal component analysis. So if you have a high-dimensional space in which your data points live, and you want to find one or two dimensions that are actually relevant for your analysis, that's where this comes in. So obviously, this is one slide picking out sort of some highlights from a very broad field. So if you want to know more, I strongly suggest going to these or any of like a quickly growing number of reviews on the topic to find out more.
Catherine,
yes?
Good question. For different claims of quantum advantages in computation, you have different sort of levels of plausibility. So, you know, the best would be if you've shown, you know, like Shor's algorithm, it's a measure of the computational complexity plot. So as long as we believe there is no efficient algorithm classically, then there's evidence of real quantum advantage.
Yes.
Whereas for Grover's algorithm, it's an oracle problem and it's less clear whether you should really claim a quantum advantage. So for these quantum advantages to machine learning, in what sense do we have evidence that it's an actual advantage? Are they oracle problems? Is it computational complexity class? What's...
They're different. These are mostly about computational complexity. I'm not sure whether there are strong results really showing that it's hard classically and easier in the quantum case. I mean, at least the amplitude amplification part, I think, essentially piggybacks on pure computational results. So it's saying you can resolve the unstructured search problem more efficiently than in the classical case, just like the same proofs you would have for Grover. And then it says, well, these are actually subroutines for a machine learning problem.
Can I ask
ask a really stupid question. What's annealing mean in this context?
You're basically looking for the ground state of a Hamiltonian of a certain class?
Uh-huh. And that's all it means?
Yes.
Nothing more mysterious, okay.
I don't think so.
All right. Okay.
Right. So this is one way you can go. You can say, let's take classical machine learning and sort of run it on a quantum computer. The other way around is to apply machine learning to studying quantum systems. And again, there are different things you can do. One class of problems is if you're trying to perform parameter estimation, estimate some Hamiltonian states or whatever, or metrology, usually there are several parameters you have to choose. For example, if you want to characterize a process, which inputs do you prepare, which measurements do you perform afterwards, and so on. And the problem of optimizing these so that you get a nice information gain for the work you do in the lab is also amenable to classical optimization methods. A second field in which machine learning is being applied. Yes?
Should I be imagining this is machine learning applied to classical information about quantum systems? Like you sort of
yes.
In your experiment, you have the input and output, classical
yeah.
data, and you're analyzing it.
Yeah. I mean, there is also research on what happens if the entire problem is quantum. So you have a system which you want to learn that is governed by the rules of quantum mechanics. You have a system that you want to learn about, which is quantum mechanical, and they're also allowed to interact in a coherent way. But that part is not nearly as well developed. I mean, it's trickier, I guess. So about the application of machine learning to condensed matter systems, there's at least one research group here working on this, Roger Melko. I don't know if anyone here is... No? Yes? Okay. Yes, ask him. Sorry? Right. Yeah. So just to sort of give a very brief idea, two things that you can do there is to look at descriptions of states in a many-body system and try to figure out which phase they're in. And even if you don't have an a priori description of what those phases look like, to actually learn to distinguish phases. So it's something that falls under unsupervised learning. Okay, so in machine learning, mostly you can divide the tasks into supervised and unsupervised learning. In supervised learning, you have a database of tagged examples. For example, pictures saying this is a cat, this is a dog, this is a cat, this is a dog, and so on. In unsupervised learning, you don't have the tags. So what you're trying to do is find some pattern, some way of meaningfully dividing your data points into clusters. And I still find it a bit surprising that this is possible because it's not you don't have very clear feedback as to whether you're right or wrong, but you're just trying to find the division that gives you the greatest, I guess, distance between the different types that you're postulating. So yeah, you can do that to learn what distinguishes phases. Another line of work studies how you can describe a state of a many-body system, which is obviously in principle very complicated, and encode it in a lower dimensional representation. So this is usually done with neural networks, where you say, I have an input on n neurons, and then I want to somehow bring that down to a bottleneck of far fewer neurons in such a way that I can roughly reconstruct it again afterwards. And the interesting thing here is that in many classes that are physically interesting, this is actually possible. And by doing this, you learn which features are actually relevant in describing that state and which parts of information are redundant. And finally, you have some applications relating to controlling quantum systems, making sure they undergo the dynamics that you want, that you can deal with noise, and also relating to the design of quantum experiments. And that's something I'll get back to later. Right, so far for the quantum machine learning in general. Now we come to autonomous learning agents. So these learning agents actually fall into a third part of machine learning. I said before you have supervised and unsupervised learning, where you have a database of points in some high-dimensional space, generically, which is given to your computer and then just sort of churns through it. But there's actually a third paradigm, which is a bit more general, which says that you simply have an agent, a system, that is allowed to interact with its environment. So your system does something. For example, it could send a query to a database, but it could also reach out its robotic arm and touch something and see, for example, whether it falls over or rolls away or something. And in response to this interaction, the agent gets a new input. And this paradigm includes supervised and unsupervised learning as special cases. You can say that the only available action is to request a data point and possibly the accompanying tag. But it also accommodates more general scenarios. For example, a robot that simply goes out into the world and interacts with it and sees what happens. And in particular, it allows for the setting where the agent can learn by itself by simply interacting in a very general way. So the idea of studying autonomous learning agents is that they're going to serve as a toy model for a wide variety of situations that can be described in this framework of interacting with the world and learning about it. And in order to build a useful toy model, there are a few features that we want. So as I said, the agent interacts with an environment. That's sort of the basic idea. One feature that we want is that the internal representation of what the agent sees and what it can do is not given by some program and sort of fixed a priori, but rather it's something that is acquired over the course of interacting with the world. So we want it to be fairly flexible. Secondly, of course, the most important thing is that this agent makes decisions that are not pre-programmed. Meaning that between these blobs representing the percepts and these others representing possible actions, you have to have some non-trivial structure. So it can't just be, you know, a matrix saying, if I see this, then I must do that. If I see this, then I must do that, and so on. There must be something more to it. And crucially, the agent must be able to modify this structure as it acquires experience interacting with the world. And in order to support this modification, usually in reinforcement learning, you assume that there's a reward. So the agent goes out, does something in the world, sees what happens, and sometimes it also gets a flag saying, you have achieved the right thing here. And based on, yes?
Is the term reinforcement learning essentially synonymous with autonomous learning? Or is there a distinction?
Reinforcement learning is a term that's fairly widely used, sort of well established. Autonomous learning, I think, captures well what I'm talking about here, but it's not a technical term. So I would say autonomous learning really emphasizes the fact that the agent does this by himself. Reinforcement learning is sort of a generic description of this kind of percept action loop.
So, yeah. I mean, a couple of things. So, like, I assume rewards could be positive and negative, right?
In principle, yes.
Yeah, so it could be punishment is a negative reward, okay. And secondly, the environment could hammer the agent without the agent doing anything at all.
Yes.
A hurricane, is that included in this? Like actions, like it's sort of, the way it's presented here is the agent is continually probing the environment and gets rewarded back.
So
the agent could be sitting there and all of a sudden, you know, get hit in the head by something, right? Is that included in this as well? Like you could get a percept without having taken any action at all.
Yes.
That's what I mean.
That's a good point. I mean, usually in order to make this tractable, we assume that it's turn-based. There, you can also consider scenarios, something called active learning, where the agent is free to go seek out the next percept as soon as he's ready. So this kind of paradigm allows you to look at how quickly the agent thinks and basically give an advantage to agents that come to a decision more quickly. The case you're describing, where it just gets an input without having done something first.
I mean, that's the real world, right?
Yes. I don't see right now how to fit this in here.
I mean, maybe to simplify, this is what they do, but ultimately in the real world, you get hammered without any warning.
Life
is, right? Not always, but sometimes. Sometimes the hammering is pleasurable, sometimes not. It depends, of course. But I'm just saying that ultimately, for this to work, you've got to have a situation where the agent does nothing and all of a sudden, zap.
I mean, one way I can see of sort of shoehorning this in here is just to introduce one additional action, quote unquote, which is simply inaction. So you sit there and you're still thinking.
Yeah, if action counts as zero, like if you could have a percept occurring with based on, in quote, inaction, sure.
Yeah.
But anyway, go ahead. I don't want to derail the thing. It just seems to me that that's a necessary ingredient in all of this.
Is what you're saying is more like an autonomous environment as well, like rather than only...
Well, if the environment's another agent, that would be the best thing. But even if it's not, right? I mean, the hurricanes, for example, they hammer you and they don't care what you think.
They have the walking robots where they... give them a shove, and they have to recover from that.
Yeah,
I think that's an example of reinforcement learning. So,
yeah, I mean, these days, robots, or for example, you may have heard about AlphaGo, the computer that defeated the world champion at Go, which was deemed impossible like 5 years ago or something. Training that machine also involved reinforcement, simply because there's no way you could sort of hard code the rules for deciding what to do in a game of Go based on some expert system.
Does that reinforcement mean it just kept playing the game until it got better and better and better? Is that really what in practice what it meant?
I'm not sure whether that's the only thing they did. That's sort of the naive meaning, at least. They may have done something more sophisticated, but I don't know the details.
Anyway, I don't want to...
Yeah, but the idea of unanticipated inputs, especially in a two-agent scenario, that might be interesting. Right, so you want the agent to be able to learn and change what's happening in here based on some reward. Maybe to clarify a question I sometimes get, how do you know it's a reward? Like, what makes it rewarding to the agent? And to clarify this, by reward, we just mean some register in the sort of in the input string. We don't actually model why this is rewarding to the agent, sort of that it's hungry and then it gets energy or whatever. It's just very abstract at this level. Right, so you have this internal deliberation process. Now, in order for this to be a useful toy model, which allows us to really see what's happening in a complex scenario, we want this internal process to be as simple as possible while still replicating what's happening. So, for example, one very popular method in machine learning at the moment are neural networks. They can do basically anything. They're also in AlphaGo. They're used in the self-driving cars. I think they're everywhere. And they work really well. But a bit of a downside is if, as a scientist, you want to be able to look at the system afterwards and say, oh, this is what happened. You know, this is what it did. This is why it's doing what it's doing. That's a bit tricky with a neural network because it's just this huge number of neurons with connections with different weights, and somehow it gets the job done. So what we want is something simpler as long as possible. And ideally, these internal rules, while simple, should also be such that the agent doesn't simply learn a sort of two-layer mapping from percepts to actions, but rather it develops some more structure internally. So I'll get back to that later on. And now I'm going to introduce one particular realization of such a learning agent, which was developed by the group that I'm working in now in Innsbruck. So this is the original paper introducing that. The idea is that, as I said before, the percepts and actions are represented internally in a way based on what the agent has experienced. So specifically, you can think of them as kind of video clips of what he's seen before. and what he can do. And these clips are arranged in a directed network where, as a liberation process, the agent performs a random walk. So when the agent sees something, one of these gets activated, and from there, the walk can proceed to any one of the actions in this case. And the probabilities of these transitions are stored in a H matrix. It's called H matrix because it's for hopping, so the walk can hop from one clip to the other. So this contains, in this model, non-negative real numbers corresponding to connections between percepts and actions. And when you see a particular percept, for example, the first percept, the probabilities of going to each of the actions are simply proportional to these weights in here. And then suppose that the agent has seen this percept, has taken some action, and then it got a reward for that. Now we want to change the weights in this transition matrix so as to make it more likely to take the same action again the next time. And the most basic no-frills way of doing that is to simply add the reward to the transitions. Now, in order for this to work without any major hiccups, we usually demand that the rewards are non-negative, because otherwise these values could eventually go to zero, and then you have a problem when normalizing to get your probabilities. So the way of having a punishment would be simply to withhold the reward. But in principle, if you choose a different function here, you could also accommodate negative rewards. You have a fair bit of freedom here. This is the most basic model. There are various additions you can make. For example, you can add in this update rule a term that represents forgetting. So the weights that represent what you've learned get actually damped back down to their initial values. And this is actually useful if you're confronted, for example, with an environment that changes over time. Because if you learn over a long time one association, say that percept 1 maps to action 2, then this value here will be very large. And if then for some reason you go into a different room or someone decides to change the rules, then you will still have for a long time this tendency to take action 2, even though it's not appropriate anymore. So damping the values and forgetting helps you to adapt more quickly to this change. There are other variations you can have to handle, for example, delayed rewards. So that's something that you get in a very common machine learning problem called the grid world. It's essentially a maze that the agent walks around in. And at the end of the maze, it gets a reward. And this is hard to learn because all the associations that the agent made between I am here now, I should go to the left, and I am here now, I should go up, and so on, all those steps will not be rewarded except for the very last step when he actually reaches the goal. And in order to speed up learning in this scenario, you can modify the update rule so that it also rewards earlier associations when you finally get the reward. But this is the basic idea. And now I'm going to present some applications of what this can do. So even though, as I mentioned before, solving reinforcement learning tasks isn't the only goal of this framework, we did also want to test it against standard tasks. And this is one of them, the mountain car problem. So in the mountain car problem, you have a car sitting in a valley. Up here is the goal that it's supposed to reach. And the problem is that this car is underpowered. So it has an engine, but simply accelerating up the slope doesn't work. It only gets so far, and then it gets pulled back down. So what the agent needs to do, given input specifying where it is and how fast it's going, it needs to figure out in which direction to accelerate. So the solution eventually would be something that accelerates one way until it turns, then accelerates the other way, and sort of keeps building up momentum until eventually it gets up here. And this is a standard task. And we tested how well the PS agent can do on this. And you can see here that the number of steps, so the number of time steps and deciding what to do that it requires until it eventually hits the target, goes down very noticeably with the number of trials it goes through. And the numbers you reach here are roughly comparable with the performance of other sort of more mainstream reinforcement learning methods.
Sorry, so what's the difference between the two curves again? So equation, plot equation.
This is using different decision methods. So
just different weightings or something?
Essentially, yeah. So the simplest possibility I mentioned here for going from these weights to actual probabilities is just normalizing. But in some cases, it's interesting to use a softmax function, which is e to the minus beta times the transition weight, and again, normalized by the possibility of transitioning to any other clips. And the point of the softmax is that by tuning the parameter gamma, it allows you to transition between a completely uniform probability distribution and one that deterministically takes the option with the highest weight. So it kind of allows you to control how greedy the agent is. Yeah, there are various parameters you can play around with here. Right, another more or less typical reinforcement learning application is robotics, actually. So this is a robot that sits in the building next to theoretical physics. Computer science people at Innsbruck are working on this robot. And what they're developing there is the ability to precisely learn autonomously. So rather than the task that the robot is working on here is to pick up a book. And the problem is that if you have these three-fingered kinds of hands, then picking up the book from the side opposite to the spine is kind of tricky because it sort of flops open and it doesn't really work. So what the robot needs to figure out eventually is that it can turn the book, rotate it in 90-degree increments until the spine is facing the right way, and then it can grab it. But as I said before, you don't want to program this as an expert, but rather you want it to learn by itself. And so the software that allows the robot to learn this, it's obviously, it has several components. It's much more complicated than just this simple kind of structure. But part of the learning process is based on this PS framework. So it really sort of runs the gamut of applications from heavy theory to actual in the lab. Right, now for some different applications in quantum experiments. This problem here is concerned with measuring a spin in a magnetic field. And the context for this is from measurement-based quantum computing, where you prepare a cluster state and you then perform quantum computations by measuring one qubit after another with the choice of measurement on subsequent qubits depending on the outcomes of previous measurement. And it turns out that you can actually translate circuit-based computing into sequences of interdependent measurements on this cluster state. But of course, the problem is if you have a magnetic field, then all your qubits in this cluster are going to start rotating, and it kind of messes up how you're supposed to measure. Now, you could apply all sorts of high-level sort of error correction or any number of methods to deal with this. But part of the appeal of having this very low-level, simple, sort of cheap model of learning is that if you could train one of these agents to somehow handle the disturbance due to the magnetic field locally, you could just put the agent right next to the qubit and have a deal with the measurement problem right there, rather than building a huge cluster out of these qubits and then trying to solve the accumulated errors afterwards. So what the agent has to do here, if it's told that the user wants to measure, say, in the plus x direction, then the agent should be able to figure out in which direction he should actually project in order to compensate for the precession due to the magnetic field. So, for example, if in the time interval in question, so we assume that the time interval is fixed, otherwise it gets more complicated. But if in the time interval in question, the qubit was rotated, say, by 180 degrees in the XY plane, sorry, 90 degrees in the XY plane, then the association that the agent would learn is that if someone asks me to measure in plus X, then I should actually measure in plus Y. So this is a, I would say, rather different ansatz to noise control. A second project was actually even more ambitious and intended to design experiments. So the idea here was that while we do know how to build experiments, for example, in this case, an optical table setup for generating various states that have high-dimensional entanglement of interesting types, generally, we don't have a very good intuition for that kind of problem. So why not turn it over to a machine? And what the agent can do here is it gets to choose from various optical elements. This is a subset. There are a few more. And place them in the various beams on an optical table. So for example, the first action could be to place a CNOT gate on these two registers. Then you could have, say, a beam splitter on, say, a wave plate on this one, and so on. Step by step, you keep building up the table. And after each action, the agent gets some feedback saying this is what the table looks like now. And possibly, if it has managed to generate an interesting state, it gets a reward. And based on this exploration, the agent does actually find a number of interesting states. So this project actually found it was able to access some Schmidt rank vectors that hadn't been generated before. But what I think is the most interesting thing is that in this learning process, whenever the agent has built a setup that generated an interesting state, it keeps a memory of that, so it uses it as a primitive. And in this process, so after we trained the agent extensively and we went back to look at what kinds of things it remembered doing a lot, you find that there are certain sequences of actions that keep reappearing. So essentially, the agent has discovered certain combinations of optical elements that are useful sort of building blocks or primitives for generally building these entangled states. And while, so this is one example of them. This is a local parity sorter. And the thing is that while I think all of the ones we found were known already to the experimental optics community, some of them weren't known all that long. And so it's quite possible that if we keep digging further, we may actually find building blocks for optical experiments that hadn't been discovered before. And this, I think, is just a really interesting possibility here. Yeah.
Perception in this case. I can see what the reward is and what the possible actions are, but what's the input?
In general, the agent would see what's on the table up to now.
So there's a given thing on the table, and the question is what to add to that?
Yeah.
So you started off with a random thing on the table? And then
you start off with an empty table, and then you see the empty table, and you have a choice of adding something somewhere. You make that choice. Then the next round, you see the table with this one element. And so
you're not really getting any new data through the perceptions, because the perceptions are just records of the actions you've previously took. It's kind of like, it's unlike learning how to get a high score in a video game in the sense that there's nothing unpredictable happening.
Well, you're not getting any new data that wouldn't be obvious to a human watching, for example. With this model, it doesn't actually have an internal memory of its own previous actions. So as far as the goings-on inside the algorithm are concerned, technically it is getting new information. It's like it forgets what it did one round ago. We're looking at the possibility of keeping a memory of previous actions. For example, if you want to handle environments where the reward actually depends on the sequence of your last two or three actions, rather than only on the most recent action. So if they're not Markovian or if they're partially hidden. But that's proving to be somewhat more complicated. Yeah?
So are the beams present to begin with, and is it able to examine the outputs? Puts an element in? How does it know what the action is? How is it making its decisions?
I'm not sure I understand. These seem like different questions to me.
I mean, I don't understand what the agent is basing any of its decisions on. How is its reward coming in this case?
So the reward is, right, so there's an interaction between two pieces of code. This is simulated. On the one hand, you have the agent part of the code that says, I want to place this kind of element in that part of the beam. And on the other hand, sort of interlaced with it, you have a simulation of this optical table. So the simulation says, OK, these are the elements on the table. Then it computes what that does to the quantum state, computes the final state, and then evaluates whether you have an interesting kind of entanglement.
It's the amount of entanglement, basically, in some measure.
Yes.
So it's getting the feedback as to what the optical element did. So there were the beams, the output of this is all part of its percepts that are helping it.
We don't actually feed a specification of the quantum state to the agent.
Only the outputs.
Only an assessment of the Schmidt rank vector. So I mean, before you run the simulation, you specify what's your target, what the reward function is. So then the reward is computed, and the reward goes back to the agent, along with a specification saying, these are the elements on the table right now, but not actually the quantum state that this generates.
So the agent can also take parts away again?
No.
But it gets messier and messier.
but then you run it many times.
It gets reset eventually. So there's a maximum number of elements that you can place. And if you reach your goal, like if you get a good state before that, then there's a reward and it gets reset to zero. And if it fills the table and still hasn't reached anything interesting, then just gets reset anyway, no reward.
But all the hopping weights get preserved under the reset? It sort of,
yes.
It's learned a bunch and then it can continue.
Yes, I mean, these are two different time scales, right? On the one hand, you're cycling through trying to build one table, and on the other hand, you've got the long-term learning process. Yes?
And how many of these sort of building blocks that are useful and known were found? Is it like three or like 20?
That I recall, there were three or four. Yeah. Okay, so this is one application to quantum mechanics. Slight change of track. This is a collaboration with philosophers in Konstanz mostly, who are trying to figure out what it means to be an agent. And so if you go to a philosophy conference on that topic, you'll hear talks on questions like, are self-driving cars responsible for their actions? How can there be an agent at the root of a causal chain if we live in a deterministic world? All those kinds of very interesting and extremely complex topics that I don't think I can really make an intelligent comment on. So I'll just sort of leave some considerations up here. For example, in some sense, agents should have their own goals. So intentions, interests. They should be aware of the consequences of their actions. That seems a bit out of reach for the model we have because it requires sort of a whole simulation of the world and awareness, which is, even harder. So there are different points people make. One point that I want to pick up on is agents decide for themselves what to do. So they're not, for example, zombies that have been programmed by some crazy scientist to do exactly whatever. And the question this raises is, if on the one hand we have laws of nature, which presumably completely specify the dynamics of the system that the agent uses to deliberate, modulo quantum uncertainties, but that's even in the classical case, if you have these deterministic laws of nature, then in what sense can you say that the output of the system, you know, to press this button or that button, came from the agent himself, as opposed to just being a generic function of whatever happened in the entire past light cone? And as you can imagine, there's been a lot of debate on this. But as physicists, what we try to offer is a concrete model. So this is code for a very simple basic learning agent. It does three things. It gets initialized, so it's got a certain number of percepts, a number of actions, and the hopping matrix, which is initially all ones, and yeah, these are the dimensions. Second thing it does is deliberate. So given a percept, it computes probabilities, transition probabilities, which in this case are simply normalized values from the H matrix. And then it chooses an action by random choice according to the probabilities it just computed. And finally, it can learn. So if it saw something, did something, and got a reward, then this reward gets added to the corresponding entry in the H matrix. Learning agent, done. Now, where does the decision come from? I mean, you've got, 12 lines of code here. Let's try to track down where the decision comes from. So the first important input, obviously, is the code itself. This is something that we as programmers put in. The second component that comes into the decision is a random choice. So if you didn't have this randomness, if the agent, for example, always deterministically chose the action that had been the most rewarded in the past, then maybe you could argue that it's just some sort of automaton. But probably the third and most important component is this H matrix, which stores a very particular subset of information that's been sort of gathered from the environment over the course of the agent's past. So what we see here is that it's not really the entire past light cone that in some generic manner influences what the decision is going to be in the end, but rather it's information that is stored in the agent, information that's relevant to the agent in the sense that it has led to rewards for the agent in the past, combined with some amount of randomness. So according to this model, this is what gives rise to the agent's own decisions. Okay, we're gonna jump fields again and go to one question from psychology, but it also relates to broader modeling questions. This is the Sally Ann test. Anyone ever heard of this? Good. So in deference to the fact that I'm in Canada, this is actually in French. But what's happening is the following. Sally and Anne, Sally has a marble, and there are two containers, which you can't see into, and Sally hides her marble in the basket. Then Sally leaves, and Anne takes the marble from the basket and puts it into the box and closes both of them again. And the question is, when Sally comes back, where is she going to look for the marble? Now, this probably seems ridiculously easy to everyone in the room, but people use this kind of test for example, very young children to test when they start being able to think about what Sally knows as opposed to what they themselves know. So in effect, whether the children are able to form a theory of mind about what's going on inside Sally. So what you believe another agent is thinking or what another agent knows. And this kind of scenario would be an operational test of a very minimal way of modeling other agents in the environment. So of studying multi-agent scenarios. And this is something we also have in mind in the future with this model. And this leads me to, so generally we're interested in the question of interacting agents and specifically collaboration and collective behavior. And yeah, this is where the biology part comes in. So as an interesting instance of collective behavior, we looked at locusts. Now, locusts are, they have great practical relevance in agriculture. When they get hungry, basically, they tend to form enormous swarms and they can devastate huge areas of land. And this, of course, prompted a lot of research into how these swarms work and what keeps them together and, in particular, how you can disrupt them, of course. So from the many results of that research, one thing that we picked out is something about the dynamics of the swarm that can be captured by a simple experiment. So you take a number of locusts and you put them in an arena, two-dimensional ring, approximately one-dimensional, that's the idea, so it's just a string that wraps around. You put a video camera on them, you use image recognition software and tracking software to figure out which way they're going, for how long, and then you make a plot something like this. You look at how aligned the group is. So are they all going one direction? Are they all going the opposite direction? Or do they kind of all do their own thing? And what you find is that sometimes they fluctuate, they don't really align very much. Sometimes they align almost perfectly for very long times, so of the order of several hours at least. And sometimes they actually flip back and forth in a roughly regular manner. And it turns out that this behavior, whether it's unorganized or highly organized, depends on the density of individuals. So basically what you see here is that while you have few individuals around, they're not very dense, they just keep walking around doing their own thing. But when the density increases, which in natural setting would be the case when the density of food drops and individuals are forced to congregate in ever smaller patches, then at some point they start to align themselves very strongly with their neighbors and they just keep marching in one direction for, well, however long it takes until they find a new food source. And so this was the kind of phenomenon that we set out to model. How do they interact? What kind of interaction rules do they have that make them do this?
So n's the number of locusts.
Yes. Yeah, in this case, they fixed the area of the arena, which was the easy thing to do, and changed the number of locusts.
And these are real locusts.
Yes.
Not yep. pseudo-simulated locusts.
No. If you want to go on YouTube, you can actually watch videos of the locusts running around. It's got a certain meditative quality to it. Yeah, so this is the data you get. And of course, there have been other models before. One very popular class are so-called self-propelled particles. So in this kind of model, you model the individuals as particles, point-like, and given the ability to propel themselves. So in response to certain situations, they can accelerate, they can change their movement. And the variable part in self-propelled particle models is what kinds of interactions you postulate. So here's one example specifically for this problem here, where you look at the average angular velocity of the animals that are walking, so one way or another. And you say that the probability of an individual turning around, so accelerating from going in this direction to going in that direction, is a function of the average angular velocity with some parameters that you choose so as to fit your data, basically. And this works. It reproduces the data. But it doesn't give you terribly much insight into what's happening at an individual level. I mean, you're saying they turn probabilistically depending on some global parameter. So what we were hoping to do is to take a much closer look by modeling each of these individuals as an agent, according to the model I showed you before, that sees what's happening around it, has some internal deliberation process, and then based on that decides what to do. So we proposed a different model where the agents learn. And so the internal deliberation, the association between what you see and what you do, is learned based on rewards. And for this problem here, we simply rewarded the agents if they aligned themselves with their neighbors. And it turns out that this reproduces the observed data very well, I think. So here you've got a model that allows you to look in much greater detail at what's happening inside each individual. And it turns out that we did not have to postulate the individual level interaction rules, but the agents could learn them themselves over time. And still we managed to reproduce the sort of collective level results.
You did this. Particular set of rules that gave this result, but you don't know whether some quite different set of rules might also give the same result.
Yes, that is true.
So,
I mean, you can gain some degree of confidence that there are no different rules if you run the simulation several times over and the individuals always come up with the same rules. So given that you reward them for some collective level behavior, do they always come up with the same rules? And if so, presumably those are the only ones? Is that helpful?
So I mean, I was thinking of, as you were going through this, a completely different set of rules, mm-hmm. which are based on, you know, I'm moving and I've got disturbances around me. So I might have some probability of turning all on my own, mm-hmm. but if I've got a crowd coming, pushing mm-hmm. me in one direction, that's going to deter me from turning, and that could result in the same.
Yes.
It seems like a different set of rules, though. There's no definite. The reward is I'm minimizing the conflict that I come into. In other words, other locusts dragging me off in the same direction, so I minimize that conflict.
Sorry, you're saying a different reward scheme might also yield the same results?
That's right.
Right. Yeah. The reward scheme we used here is probably the point I'm most eager to change, because essentially what we're asking is whether they come to align themselves globally if we reward them for aligning themselves locally. They're kind of closely related. It's not a very interesting sort of challenge. The reason we started with this reward scheme is simply technical. So if you were to try to model something more realistic, for example, I'm going to reward the entire swarm once they've managed to cross the Atlantic and find more fertile food. You could do that. But that's an extremely delayed reward. It's going to take many, many turns until that happens. And this generally translates directly to a harder learning problem. It just takes so many more iterations till you get any kind of learning effect. And also, some of the other work in biology on how these phenomena arise allowed the agents to have a much more detailed perception. For example, they looked at, they performed experiments with actual locusts, looking at how they respond when there's an individual approaching from the front or approaching from behind or receding from the front, or all these differences. And so probably it would be more realistic to try and give our agents this kind of perception. But the problem is that this gets extremely high dimensional. And yeah, I'll get back to that point later. So we're working on it, but right now it's the best we can do.
But I mean, it may not be unique, but okay, so what? I mean, why would we expect it to be?
It depends what you build on it. I mean, this is sort of a low-level problem, but if you're trying to build something larger, then the behavior that you find in this particular scenario mm-hmm. May, depending on your set of rules, it may give you a different result when you go into a more complex.
Well, sure, but I mean, that's sort of like, you know, different animals, right? Some might get different rewards, they go in different environments, they do different things. I mean, okay, but I don't see why. I mean, the point is they found something that works,
yeah,
right?
I mean, we would like to be able to say that this is actually what happens. But
I mean, it's clear if you put other animals in this, they won't necessarily do the same thing, right? Snakes,
right.
I don't think, will do this. I mean, you know.
Right. So, let's see. Right, so this behavior here, this model does reproduce a collective level behavior, just the fact that they all align. But it doesn't actually require a lot of interaction. And in a sense, there isn't any real gain for the agents from the fact that they're all doing the same thing. So a different example is collective sensing. Collective sensing is a phenomenon that you see in a very wide range of life forms. I don't think I can even say animals. Bacteria, for example, that are trying to travel to some higher density of sugar or whatever it is they like, they exhibit something similar. So in broad terms, the problem is that you have some desirable resource, nice water temperatures, luminosity, chemical substances, which is distributed unevenly. So that a single individual that's just trying to follow the gradient to get to the highest density is bothered by that noise and ends up taking a rather circuitous route. And it turns out that if you have a swarm of individuals, they can essentially average over what their neighbors are seeing and thereby compensate to some degree for that noise and in the end reach the target more efficiently. So in this case, the individuals really benefit from the fact that they actively look to the others around them. And this you can model in a more abstract scenario. So you've got a two-dimensional world with a resource. So this is a reward density distributed according to a Gaussian distribution. And you've got the individuals, which can just go around here. And in this case, the individuals do actually see their neighbors with a somewhat high degree of resolution. So they can see how many neighbors are in front of them, to the left, to the right, closer, farther away. And based on this input, they decide in which direction to turn. They've got a fixed speed, but they can turn. And what we wanted to see was whether a single individual that cannot see its neighbors does, taking the isolated individual as a baseline, we wanted to see whether the ones that are allowed to interact eventually come to learn that they need to look to their neighbors and thereby outperform the ones that cannot rely on the swarm. And so what you see here is exactly the blue line is the baseline. This is the best an agent can do if he can't rely on his neighbors. The green is an estimate of how well he can possibly do if he does rely on his neighbors. And these ones here are the learning agents. So initially, they're really confused, especially because they're all learning at the same time. So initially, their neighbors aren't doing anything useful either. But eventually, they figure it out, and they do go up here. And I would expect that asymptotically, they get up to this optimum. So they really learn this collective strategy. Right, now to the final big question. Can they learn structured models? So there are a number of reasons for wanting to have more complexity than just a flat two-dimensional assignment table inside the agent's brains. For one thing, this actually improves performance as practical tasks. So for example, if you have a percept space that has several dimensions, for example, pictures with several pixels, then it would be very helpful if you could process, for example, one part of the picture separately from another part of the picture, rather than having to learn what to do if the picture looks like that and what to do if one bit is changed, and so on. A related problem is generalizing to novel situations. If just one tiny piece of context changes, the naive, simplest agent would simply have to learn again what to do from scratch. And that's crippling if you're in an environment that changes all the time. It also kind of ties into handling continuous variables, because continuous variables you can just represent as a high-dimensional space. So for example, in the mountain car problem that I mentioned earlier, the speed and the position are in principle continuous variables. And the way we've handled it so far is to simply impose a rigid discretization beforehand as an additional layer. And this, for one thing, can of course hamper performance. If there's some part of phase space where you need higher resolution, you won't get that. And generally, it's just not a very elegant solution, because you would like the entire system to be homogeneous and be able to handle the challenge by itself without additional components. So far for the practical side. Also, from the theoretical scientific side, it would be very nice if we had a toy model that captures things like the ability to recognize context and figure out that, for example, if I learned a skill that works at home, then maybe it also works at work. We would like to be able to see the agents forming abstractions, so recognizing that red cars and blue cars and yellow cars are all cars and should be handled the same way. And also, in a this kind of structure would, I think, support causal thinking. So an agent that interacts with an environment where there are different causal mechanisms at work would ideally be able to figure out that these are separate causal mechanisms and build a structured model that generalizes more readily. And finally, from a technical side, if you have a more modular representation of your memory that's more efficient simply in terms of storage space. So there's definitely good reason to want to do this. There have been some attempts to do this. For example, proposing loops inside this this clip network, saying that if you see a red arrow, it's kind of like a blue arrow, so you can just hop across to the blue arrow and maybe you know what to do for the blue arrow. Another idea was to, if you're given a percept that has two features, for example, a color and a direction, to allow the agent to selectively ignore one of those features. So saying, yes, I saw a green arrow pointing to the left, but that's just an arrow pointing to the left, therefore I should do whatever. Another approach was to ad hoc postulate that the deliberation structure is actually modular, that it breaks down into, for example, one part that processes visual input from the right, another part that processes visual input from the left, and they're actually identical, you can learn them at the same time, and then finally one smaller part that integrates the two, rather than having one big matrix from 16 inputs to two outputs. And all these approaches have worked within limited settings, but I think there is still a more general solution we can come up with that doesn't rely, obviously, on a priori hard coding of the structure or the assumption that your percepts come in a neat product structure and that this is actually the structure that is relevant for your problem. And so what we would like to do is come up with learning rules that, well, firstly, modify the deliberation process in such a way that you can have, you can look at multiple components at the same time. For example, in this case here, you would be able to activate both left and green and have them interact in some way later on in the process so that you can represent the fact that if it points to the left and I see green, then I do one thing, but if it points right and I see green, then I do a different thing. And so this deliberation part we have actually tested in another scenario with fish, where we wanted them to stick together in a swarm. It's a very basic ability that they need. If you want to have any kind of interaction, you first have to make sure that there's somebody around to interact with. And this task also required a fairly high dimensional input, basically seeing where all your neighbors are located. And so we proposed exactly this ad hoc structure, taking different components of the input, pre-processing them separately down to some smaller size, and only afterwards integrating them. And in this case, we could verify that it does actually give you a noticeable speed up in the learning curve. So this is a measure of success, sort of how closely they managed to stick together. And you can see that after longer training times, they do reach the same asymptotic behavior. But the point is that these green guys, which have this modular structure, they learned it much more quickly than the blue ones, simply because this one has far fewer edges than if you just multiplied these two inputs out and built one big matrix. So this part works. The problem, the real problem, is how to develop this kind of structure. So we'd need some kind of learning rule that can, for example, capture the fact that certain clips in your network are operationally equivalent, so that it doesn't make a difference whether I see a red car coming towards me or a blue car or a green car, they're all going to crash. Next, once you've identified that there are some things you can ignore, you should create a new clip that represents the abstraction, so the shared feature of all these equivalent things. And the problem is when you do create clips, you have to figure out how to connect them to the existing network. So these are the desiderata. This is very much an open problem that I'm still working on. So if you have any thoughts on this, I would definitely be very interested in discussing. And yeah, this brings me to a sort of summary of highlights. On the quantum machine learning side, you have various speedups and advantages that you can gain by running machine learning with quantum implementations. when you apply classical machine learning to quantum systems, you gain, in some cases, useful tools, for example, for controlling noise or characterizing processes. In particular, you can, in some cases, let the machines actually do discovery for you. So, for example, the optical tables experiment that discovered building blocks, or in the condensed matter case, where you learn what characterizes a phase of matter in a compact way. Then for the autonomous learning agents, so we propose them as toy models that allow you to have a simple understanding of all sorts of different things. For example, in what sense an agent can make its own decisions in a deterministic world, giving a less ad hoc picture of where collective motion comes from. And finally, hopefully in the future, having agents that can learn structures, learn abstractions, and give us a glimpse of how that works. And with that, I'll give a shout out to my colleagues in Innsbruck, the current ones and previous people who have worked on this project. And with that, I think I'll wrap up and thank you for your attention.
So can I ask, like, in the talk, it's a very interesting talk, but it seemed to me all the learning was all classical physics, or did I miss something? Like, where was the quantum advantage? I saw classical machine learning developing the I saw machine learning for the optical table.
Yes.
But that's all classical learning to get the, was quantum used anywhere, or did I miss it?
You didn't miss it. The examples I presented here of these learning agents, these are all where the agent is classical.
Yeah.
We have considered the case where you make this agent quantum. So another design feature, I would say, of this framework is that the deliberation process is a random walk. So in principle, you can actually substitute this for a quantum random walk. And there is one paper showing that under certain particular conditions on the kind of graph you have here, you can actually get a speed up. So the time it takes you to reach a decision is quicker. And then there's also the case where you have a fully quantum setting. So you have some system that is capable of modifying itself, interacting with another system and environment, and both of them are fully quantum, and also the interaction is coherent. But so there is a basic framework for how you can think about this. It's tricky to even say how you could have learning in this case, because so long as you have just a global unitary, in principle, if you apply the right unitary, you can just unlearn the entire thing. That's
sort of quantum stupidity.
Well, optional quantum stupidity. You can kind of learn in one way, but there is always the possibility of unlearning everything.
Yeah. But you could, are you contemplating? Are people going to make, quantum fish or quantum locusts or something, where the learning with all these agents is based on something that's, quantum random?
Yes, that might be interesting. I guess, for example, if you look at looking at the robotics application, in that case, there might be a very real advantage to be gained from having quicker choice processes.
But just that, I don't think there are any quantum locusts. But it just, if one could ask, right, is there some
resolve the question
quantum process that would cause the locusts to do what locusts do more quickly or something, then you'd see if locusts, if they were quantum, would have an advantage, right? It's an abstract question. It's not real biology.
I think the biggest impact might be the quantum, the random numbers. Right? At the present, you're using pseudo-random numbers.
Yes.
So
yeah, genuine.
The true system is going to be random.
Yeah, that would be another example. But I'm just saying anything that where you would really have some learning process that we know for sure is not classical.
Yeah. As far as the randomness or pseudorandomness is concerned, as far as I can see at this point, I see no compelling reason to assume that the randomness that comes into this kind of decision process needs to be quantum in origin. I mean, you can just have, thermal noise of molecules floating around in your brains, perfectly sufficient. But yeah, we might actually be able to probe it if someone comes up with a theory that sort of predicts some difference.
So, like the value, like the magnitude of the rewards could really affect the way you're learning, like the agent is learning. So, for example, because you're normalizing it, it will affect the probability. So, let's say instead of 5, it's 100.
Yeah.
It's going to do the same thing again and again.
Yes.
Very soon.
Yeah.
And if there are many, there can be local maximums for some goal, but there could be also a global maximum. So
yes. So
would it be interesting to introduce a randomization in like such that the agent tries to come out of the local maximum?
So this is a problem that's been considered quite extensively in reinforcement learning. It's usually phrased as exploration versus exploitation. So if you've started to interact with your world and you have some pieces of information, you know that some things have yielded a reward in the past, should you just blindly keep going for them, or should you keep exploring to see what else might be out there? And one way to handle this greed parameter that I introduced earlier. So what people do in practice is they actually change beta throughout the course of learning. And initially, they make beta close to zero. So that even though you already have some information, you still choose more or less randomly what to do, so you just keep exploring. But then eventually, once you think for whatever reason that you have a good deal of information, you can increase beta and thereby start going for the things that you actually know are most rewarding.
But is that a parameter controlled by the agent or the programmer?
You could go either way. We have played around with having a sort of additional learning routine that actually regulates beta depending on, I forget what the exact criteria were, but some measure of how well you're doing. And so, for example, if you then have a sudden change in the environment, this condition was tripped, so the agent actually went back to exploring. Yep.
Has there ever been any contemplation of letting agents change the software of the other agents, right? So you've got this thing, the environment changes you, but what if an agent gets rewarded by modifying the probabilities of the other agents, right? And then you get this highly nonlinear interaction,
which is
sort of closer to the real world, right?
That would be a very interesting question for a multi-agent scenario. We hadn't actually considered that yet, but...
Or
modifying the reward system. Well,
yeah, that's right. The idea, well, effectively, that's what I mean. The rewards update the percepts, but what if the action is to change that before the, you know, agent A changes the reward structure of agent B before B has a chance to get its own feedback, right?
Or,
well, maybe it'll result in cooperation. I don't know.
I mean, it seems like something game theory might have something to say about.
Well, it probably would, sure. But I mean, it seems to me a reasonable thing to try. I don't know how hard it is to program, but it doesn't seem to me to be all that difficult.
No, I think the biggest task would be to come up with a scenario that's well-defined and interesting and where you expect to see something.
Competition amongst animals for food, or maybe cooperation amongst them for food or something, you know, I don't know.
When we're talking about it would be nice for the agents to kind of learn the structure of themselves. It seems like something that like the neural networks could be able to do in some simple scenarios.
Yes.
Do you think that could work potentially?
Yeah, so neural networks are, as I said, used very extensively. Actually, when you look at these motivations here, like all these problems, high-dimensional environments, generalization to novel situations, that's something that neural networks can definitely do. The only reason why I'm not so keen to use neural networks is because they don't allow you to look back at what the system has learned and really understand what's going on.
Okay, but once you have the structure itself, maybe you don't care how you got the structure, but then you can use the structure to perform other tasks, and by by learning this structure then helps you know what you were doing.
I see what you mean. I still think
it
feels a bit like cheating still, because you're saying, well, the hard part is really done by the neural network, right?
Okay, but maybe like once you have the structure, which is kind of simpler for some reason,
mm-hmm.
you can label it yourself or interpret it easier than like the original or like the neural network itself.
I mean, it might be worth a try to see whether you can at least learn once you have certain some pieces of information.
I was thinking already before that if, like, we don't know what the neural network is doing, maybe we could employ another neural network to interpret what that neural network is doing.
See? Multi-agent scenarios.